Hi, it's Lucy, and welcome to another episode of The Real Girls Club, my podcast where I interview women working in the film and TV industries. For today's episode, I was very lucky and very excited to be able to interview Mary Harron. I've wanted to have her on the podcast for ages, and I'm both surprised and grateful it's finally happened. Mary is a director and screenwriter known most famously for directing American Psycho, starring Christian Bale. She has an impressive resume of feature films, including I Shot Andy Warhol, Charlie Says, and Dalliland. In this interview, we talk about Mary's early days as a music journalist for a punk magazine, her first steps into filmmaking, her advice for aspiring filmmakers, and so much more. Here is Season 2, Episode 8 of The Real Girls Club. I'm so glad we've managed to finally get our time synced up. But yeah, thank you so much for being on my podcast today. I'm really excited to speak to you. I've got quite a lot of questions to ask you today, but hopefully we can get through as many as we can and mostly be able to get through the most important ones. I'd like to start at the beginning, particularly your beginnings. You're a Canadian native, but you've also lived in, of course, New York and England, but of course now you've settled now in New York. So I'd love to know what your formative years looked like, from school to work experience and then your first steps into the film industry.
Yeah. So, yes, I born in Canada. My parents are Canadian. My dad was an actor. So we spent a lot of time, my early years, traveling and moving, some time in Canada, some time in New York City when I was 3 and 4, where my dad was working off-Broadway, some time at the Canadian Shakespeare Festival, where my father met Katharine Hepburn, who took a shine to him and arranged a screen test for him in Hollywood. So I was, just before I turned 5, we moved to Beverly Hills, to Los Angeles, and my dad was under contract at Paramount for a couple of years. So I lived in Hollywood, and then my parents got divorced. And when I was 7, moved to live with my grandparents, my sister and I, in a small town in North Ontario. So we went from living in Beverly Hills to this little town. And then a couple years later, moved to Toronto with my mother, 4 years there. And then my mother married a Hungarian writer and we moved to Italy for a year. And then when I was 13, we moved to London, England. And then I spent my teenage years in London, and then I went to university in England.
Yes, you went to the University of Oxford to study English.
Right. Yeah. And at that point, obviously, because my dad was an actor and I'd lived in Hollywood, and, you know, when they were divorced, my father had married a sort of Hollywood starlet named Virginia Leith, who was actually discovered by Stanley Kubrick and was the female in his main character in his first film, Fear and Desire. And so, you know, I knew about the movie. I grew up around the movies because my dad was, you know, we would go and spend summers in Los Angeles for a couple of years. So I was definitely around theater and film. I think that probably helped me because it was not an unknown world for me. Mm-hmm. But I really never thought of being a director. I wouldn't say it never occurred to me, but I thought I would be a writer when I was young. And then when I was a teenager, I was also very into art and I thought I would go to art school. So a lot of my sort of teenage years were about doing art classes and, you know, looking at art. And then one of my teachers suggested I try for Oxford. So I thought, oh, someone thinks I'm smart enough to do that. I got very focused on that. I mean, I never know. It was like one of those life-changing things if I'd gone to art school. I'm not really a painter, I don't think. Or I think I probably would have ended up in film or photography earlier, probably. Right. But when I was I did some acting at Oxford, and then I edited the university magazine. And I was very focused on being a journalist, you know. And when I left college, I went to Toronto for a bit, back to Toronto, lived with my sister. And then I went to New York in 1975 for a friend's birthday party, one of my Oxford friends. And I just like fell in love with New York City. This is a time when everybody thought New York was terrible. It was like, you know, crime ridden and dangerous and dirty. And I just thought it was the greatest, most exciting place in the world. So I just packed all my stuff in garbage bags and got a train after I went back to Toronto and moved to New York. Yeah. And I got a job in a film commune. It's such a crazy story. A job where they used to have these jobs where you could advertise jobs for room and board. And I got one with a film commune, which was a really ridiculous hippie film commune. I worked there for a few weeks in the Lower East Side in the East Village. And when I was there, I met Legs McNeil, this kid Legs McNeil, who was starting Punk Magazine. And so I got involved he said his writing for them and going to CBGBs and, you know, found an apartment in St. Mark's Place, a legendary street in the East Village. And I just was very involved in the sort of New York punk scene, you know, which was early, before the London punk scene. So I was very involved in that and writing for this punk
the
magazine.
It's called Punk Magazine.
It was the first, it sort of helped give the movement its name, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few months later in that summer of 76, I went to London, back to London, because I had a ticket back. And I did all these interviews, interviewed the Sex Pistols, interviewed some other people.
Can I ask what it was like to interview the Sex Pistols?
Oh, yeah. They were actually, it was funny because it was a concert in Liverpool, actually. And they were, it was like half empty, but I thought they were great. And it was, you know, it's funny because it was just quite a small movement then. Sid Vicious wasn't even in the band yet.
Oh, okay. He joined later.
Yeah, it was an early show. I thought they were great. And I went backstage and I had a t-shirt that said Punk Magazine and all these kids.
So we knew where you were from.
Yeah, they looked very scary because they were all in sort of rubber and leather. And they came up to me and they looked like sort of like Susie and the Banshees followers. And I realized they were all really sweet and they were hairdressers from Liverpool, most of them. Yeah, they were all like, you know, fashion kids. They wanted to be the Sex Pistols. So I just brought them with me to the interview backstage. And at that point, Johnny Rotten, as he was then known, was very nice to me. I found out later he didn't like the piece I wrote, but he was nice to me because I wasn't from a big magazine. I was just from this little punk magazine. So I did this interview and then went back to New York and it was published. Then I wrote probably the first big piece about punk rock for an American magazine, really, for the Village Voice. So that was all, you know, the very cutting edge of punk. It was good because I sort of had the experience of seeing something that was very small. It was just a little club, tiny club in, off the Bowery. And then it becoming this worldwide thing, you know, that's still, you know, almost 50 years later, still very important. I did that. And then I was very, very involved in all that world. And at some point, I did think, oh, maybe I should try and study film, you know, go to NYU, do a film course.
So there was like a light bulb moment.
No, it was, I didn't know how this occurred to me. It was just like, oh, that's something I'd like to do. Maybe make films. But then I didn't do anything about it. And I was trying to be a journalist and working. And then as the initial punk scene sort of wound down, I thought, it's been so incredibly exciting for like almost 2.5 years or whatever. And I just thought, oh, it's changing. And I just need to get away. I went and lived in France for a few months, in Paris. And then I moved back to London and just became a journalist and wrote for music papers because the sort of focus of excitement in music had sort of moved to England. And I ended up writing for the Melody Maker and then for The Guardian and the New States. But I was really sort of didn't want to be writing about music. I really wanted to be doing something different. And I ended up, a lot of my friends had gone into television. I was living in the house, actually, of Adam Curtis, who's a very famous documentary maker. And I was just like really jealous because Adam was doing all these exciting things and I had other friends working in television. At that point, I was in my late 20s. I didn't like what I was doing. And I realized that if you don't like what you're doing, you just have to stop
change
doing it.
Yeah. You get that feeling like, okay, I've finished doing this. Now I want to move on to something else.
Yeah, for the few years, it was exciting. And then I just didn't like reviewing concerts. I'm not that much of a music person. Mm-hmm. I really like writing about the world. I wasn't really writing about music. I was writing about the culture around the music.
Mm-hmm. And you're interested in the scene and the people.
Scene or the little subcultures that grow up in rock music. And I was very fascinated by that. And, you know, I did a piece about heavy metal or I do a piece about this or that group. I got very into writing about country music in Nashville. And that world was very interesting to me, but I didn't like just reviewing concerts or reviewing records. Mm-hmm. It was just like, what am I doing with my life? And I felt like, I had such an exciting time in my early 20s in New York in this new scene and been so lucky to sort of stumble on all this. And I felt that in my late 20s, I was kind of paying for it because I hadn't done the kind of organized career things that all my friends had done. That never occurred to me to really organize my career like.
So when you came out of university, you just sort of didn't have a plan necessarily.
No, I was going to be a writer. I thought I'm going to go to South America.
Yeah.
I wanted to go to and learn Spanish, you know, and get jobs somehow. I just, you know, I was very unplanned, but it worked out for me, actually, I have to say. And I think as long as you're kind of open to the opportunities that present themselves.
Right.
But at that point, by later, I thought, I really need to learn something. I need structure. I need more. I didn't like being a freelance journalist, very tough life. You know, it's very lonely and it's kind of isolating. I didn't love it. And then just when I turned 30, it was like, oh, I'm 30. My life's over. And
I'm getting there.
I'm nowhere. And then a friend, someone I knew, had known in the music press at Melody Maker, called me because they were doing a pilot for a pop music show. They just started Channel 4 in Britain, and they had this idea of this new music show. So he asked me to be a researcher on this pilot. And I really loved doing that, and I liked being working in an office. And so the show got picked up for a season, and I worked on that. And I did research on stories, and I wrote the questions for the pop star interviews, you know, asking Boy George this or that, or the 80s. It was 80s pop music. It was kind of a fun time. And then I applied for a sort of serious job. I had a friend who worked on the South Bank show, this big arts documentary show in Britain. Mm-hmm. Went through, I don't know, the 70s through to the 90s. And they did big arts, prestige arts documentary. So I went up for that because this a friend from college also worked on it. And I got a job on that. And so then I worked for the next 4 years as a researcher. It was a great job, actually, an enviable job. But I was also very frustrated because I didn't, at that point, I really wanted to direct. I wanted to make documentaries. That's what I thought I could do, like do, because that's what I was working in. Mm-hmm. And I remember being, I was at dinner at my parents' house, my mother and stepfather's house, and they had sort of odd story. Michael Foote, who at that point was the head of the Labour Party, and his wife, I think her name was Jill Craigie. And she was had made, I think, the first feature film directed by a woman. And she was there. And my parents were talking about me, you know, complaining because I had been offered. I still had been working as a journalist part-time as well as working in as a research and television. And I'd been offered a job at the Sunday Telegraph or the Daily Telegraph, can't remember, to be a theater critic there because mm-hmm. I'd been doing theater reviews. And I had turned it down because I wanted to stay in television as a researcher. And my mother was just distraught by having turned down this prestigious job. And so I remember Jill Craigie saying, no, she's absolutely right. This is wonderful. You should be doing this. And she said, and of course, then you'll make feature films. I remember being so like shocked and like embarrassed. No, I can't. No, I wouldn't. I can't possibly. And shocked and embarrassed that anyone thought that I could make a feature film. That seemed like...
She believed in you before you did.
Yes, I guess so. I don't know why she said that, but she
planted it in your head.
She should do feature films. And that was the first person who ever said that. Anyway, I was working on these films of famous artists at the South Bank Show. And one of them, I was asked to be the researcher on a documentary about Jackson Pollock. So before then, because I was in sort of charge of the theater research, the theater programs, and I did was the researcher and suggested them doing and really organized everything about a film about this New York theater group called the Worcester Group, who are a very important kind of avant-garde theater company. And their most famous sort of alumnus is Willem Dafoe. And yeah. Willem Dafoe was the partner of the theater director, Elizabeth Lecomte. So I got to be very friendly with them. And when I started working on this Jackson Pollock film, I had told Liz Lecomte about this, and she said, I need to write a screenplay. Will you come and write it with me? So this was like amazing to me that someone where I had no experience, even though she knew I'd been writing screenplays with a friend, like mm-hmm. working on scripts, but I had never done anything. And I told her about, I'm working on these scripts. I don't know. I'd never done anything professionally. And so for her to ask me, that was just amazing. So for 2 or 3 years, I spent all my money flying and holiday time flying back to New York to work on this screenplay, which in the end, we lost the rights to this book and it never got made. But I had a wonderful experience working with Liz Lecomte because she had never written a screenplay either. We just had all these screenplays that Willem had been sent, mm-hmm. like by David Lynch and other people. Like, so we'd read these screenplays and look how they were done. And we just kind of made it up as we went along, but there were no rules. She was a big rule breaker. Mm-hmm. She was obviously a very famous theater person. I was a few years older than me. And I didn't get paid. I did all this for free. I never got paid for any of it. And I would pay my own way back and forth. But I certainly was in this world of writing this script. And then with my best friend from the CBGB's days, Frances Pelsman, who was a photographer, we had been writing scripts. It just had ideas. They were more like satires and comedies. And so we'd been working on that together, and we just had this idea of different things we would work on, but we had no kind of foothold in the industry. Anyway, while all this was going on, writing scripts with my friend, working on the script with Leslie Compton, all this in addition to the work I was doing. And it's very important, I think, when if you're doing something that's not what you mainly want to do, then you have to kind of, I felt I learned a lot from working in television. I learned a lot of both practical skills and working with a team and an office. I got a lot out of the jobs I had to do for money. But at the same time, you really can't, if you have a larger ambition, you can't let go of your ultimate goals. You have to kind of work on those in your spare time. So I spent, I think, a lot of time of my spare time working on what I really wanted to do.
It was always in the back of your mind, yeah.
Yeah. And then in sort of the last year or so of my working at the South Bank show, I was asked to work on the research on a documentary about Andy Warhol. And as a journalist, I've been even at college, I'd written about Warhol's factory. So I had a long time, and I as a music writer, I'd written a lot about the Velvet Underground. I'd written a whole history of the Velvet Underground. So I had really already talked to and interviewed a lot of the people in that world of the Warhol 60s. And so then I got the chance to do it all again for this documentary. And while I was working on that documentary, that's when I saw a copy of Valerie Solanas's Scum Manifesto in a left-wing bookstore in Brixton, where I lived. And when I read it on the subway, and then I was just like, complete revelation. I thought, I've got to make a film about the woman who wrote this and find out who she was. So this is my first film.
I read in an article that you're fascinated by people who have done terrible things or characters
I
on.
think I said that. I don't know if that's true, but it's just one.
Okay, just one of the things you said. Or
Just one.
characters that are on the edge of madness, as they
I know. I
say.
think I'm bullshit. I don't know. Maybe I am. I don't know. I mean, certainly, although that's sort of how what I've fallen into as well, because I think if you make a film about one thing, one person who's kind of on the edge of madness, then people offer you more projects like that. There's also that.
Right, I
So
see.
whether or not I would only have done that, so I was writing before I made actually Andy Warhol, we're not like that. So it's just, yes, I'm interested in that, but I think it's also something that the path that I was set on by the impact that my first film had. I think that's from the New York Times, I think. I think that was sort of how they wanted to package me. And it's okay. I mean, I really like that was a very nice article that they wrote in the New York Times, but who knows?
So what would you say attracted you to the story of Valerie Solanas?
I think I am interested in, I was interested in that she was not a conventional feminist heroine, that she was very contradictory and, I don't know, morally ambiguous isn't necessarily the right word to describe it. She was a brilliant woman who did terrible things. She had some brilliant insights, and she had some that was kind of closer to madness, But she had a vision, and there was an enormous amount of truth in her vision. And I felt like she had been relegated as this kind of just crazy lady. And when I read the Scum Manifesto, which was so well written and had so much brilliant insight into what people are now talking about now, about gender, even though she was a transphobe, she was a TERF, I think. But she had a lot of very visionary insight into the complete falseness of male and female relations, the absurdity of these notions of women's inferiority and how that played out in society and everything. So she was just a really brilliant woman. But when I read it, I thought, my God, I thought she was just some bag lady, some crazy person. I said, what? The people you see on the street are homeless or like eating out of garbage cans. They could be geniuses, There's genius everywhere. And I was very excited about this idea because I've been working in such a hierarchy of culture about doing films about famous artists. Almost all of them men, or a great many of them men. And it just thought, oh, this is kind of upending the whole notion of where brilliance is. So that was that. And then I like the fact that she was so contradictory, and in some ways, yes. I mean, in some ways, when I say on the edge of madness, or people who do, she did do terrible things. So in some ways, that quote has some truth in it. And there was a lot of resistance into doing a film about her because people said, "Why don't you do a film about a sort of more respectable, great artist. And that's not interesting. That's not dynamic to me. What's interesting is the things that you are hard to reconcile in someone like Valerie.
Would you say then it was quite a long haul to get there to get the film made?
It was about 7 years, I'd say, from having the idea. Yeah.
Right, okay.
I mean, obviously, I was doing other things because I was still a researcher. And then the following year, I went to the BBC to direct for a show, BBC Two, called The Late Show, which was a talk show that had a lot of short films. And that was a great opportunity because I had to make a lot of films quite quickly.
Of course, I want to talk about your film American Psycho, though I'm sure you've talked about it.
I'm super bored with it.
you're talked out of it, but I'm not going to make you rehash all the things you've already said a million times about it because I have read a lot about it. I think what I'm most interested in is because I rewatched it the other day before this interview, and I couldn't help thinking how iconic Christian Bale's performance is. Of course, he's a great actor anyway. But yeah, he's become sort of part of meme culture now, and the film's a cult classic. So I'd just be fascinated to know how you got such an amazing performance out of him and how you worked with him on set.
Well, there was a lot of time in between us making the film, from my casting him to actually getting the film made. At one point he was fired. We were both fired because they wanted to cast Leonardo DiCaprio. So anyway, Christian and I had, and he was in California and I was in New York, and we had a lot of time. So a lot of phone calls while we were waiting to make the film and for the green light, where we talked a lot about the character, and he would call me with some new insight he'd had. And we came up, I mean, it's hard to say. We would just always had a real rapport about how we saw the character. We saw the character as kind of absurd and somewhat pathetic. And we had this idea that he was like a Martian who just didn't know how to be a human being and was kind of trying
Emotionless.
to, yeah. Well, no, not well, very insecure, actually.
Right.
I wouldn't say emotionless,
No, he did have emotion, but very cold, I don't know.
He had a lot of rage and insecurity, and he was trying to find out how to be a human being by watching others and imitating others. And that's very much part of his performance.
Yeah,
Yeah. A lot of,
that was
there's a
going
lot of
on.
narcissistic rage too, and insecurity, because nothing's ever good enough for you. It's just sort of a thing of narcissism.
Were you sort of surprised that it becomes so like such a cult classic years later and turned up in memes and the internet culture? Has that surprised you or is it
Yes,
quite no?
that surprised me. Yeah, for
Yeah.
sure. I mean, you can't predict that, and you can't. I mean, I think it's a good film, and I think it's a very graphic looking film, and it has and it also benefited because Christian is so great in it that there's something very iconic about the character. And then Christian became very famous because he was Batman, and so all those things came together to make that film, memeable.
Meme-worthy, yeah. Yeah, I can think of one particularly that I always see online. It's of him walking into the office with headphones on, and people have replaced it with like their own song.
Yeah.
Of them walking into the office with whatever music they like, and then or the card scene as well
Yeah.
that shows up a lot on online, how it's very intense and they're all like discussing who's got the best card. You also had, I mean, like apart from Christian Bale, like you had also like a lot of amazing other actors on board, Willem Dafoe and Reese Witherspoon. How did you go about casting them? Was that
I knew Willem from the Worcester Group, obviously.
of
I'd
course.
known him for years. And then Reese was very successful, but she was not yet as famous, but it really helped get the film financed. So I just went and had coffee with her, and I was very, it's really great that she decided to sign on to such a controversial project,
Yeah, I mean, when you think about what she's done, like Legally Blonde, it's like chalk and cheese, as they say, in
Yeah, but
terms of
that
what
was
kind of films
weird.
they
This
were.
was pre-Legally Blonde, so it was,
Yes, it was
and
pre
at
yeah,
that
Legally
point she could still make a risky choice like
Blonde.
that. I think when you become super famous, it's harder.
Do you stick quite closely to the script, or are you quite open to improv and letting the actors go off script?
In that film, not at all. That we did not change a word of the script.
Okay, so it was very
But
much like, okay,
yeah,
to the point.
the only film I did a little bit of it, some improvising in I Saw Andy Warhol with the actors in the party scenes around the factory. But I found that was difficult to edit. And then when I made Charlie Says, I let Matt Smith do a great deal of improv, because a lot of what Charles Manson is saying is kind of gibberish, really. And he just listened to a lot of Charles Manson talking, and he sort of internalized it. And he would just kind of do these like raps, almost these like monologues that were kind of nonsensical, but had this rhythm to them. And he said, you know, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to have to improvise. And this is one case where I felt like, because he came in and Matt Smith came in and read for me as Charles, and he was very electrifying and very unpredictable. And I thought, that's good that this is one case where you have to let someone do that. Normally, I do not. No, I mean, I stayed have worked with Ben Kingsley, and you can't change a word. You know, he does, you know, he just arrives with this great performance. And I mean, he'll improvise a little bit, but on the whole, I would say I stick to the script.
Okay, yeah, but it's also very much unique to the actor and to the film as well that
Yes,
you're
it's to
shooting.
the it's really about the context of it. Yeah.
Other things that I was thinking about back to American Psycho, but promise we'll go away from that afterwards. But another thing that I was thinking about when I was watching it is, well, I read also another article, not about you, but about how not every film about women or by women needs to be a feminist masterpiece. And I thought about this when I was watching American Psycho. I thought, well, you know, Patrick Bateman is far from a feminist, even if it is a satire, and even though it centers around a male main character. Do you feel that female directors are often expected to exclusively create feminist films? And how do you navigate, sorry, the industry's expectations when you're exploring these darker themes?
I mean, I think that's probably true that they, you know, that or that the industry likes to characterize or have. I mean, I would, but actually, when I started, I don't think anybody, when I started in the mid 90s, people weren't at all interested in feminist films. You know, feminism was not fashionable, or it wasn't. I would say that the film, actually, Andy Warhol, which is about a kind of feminist anti-hero, the subject matter made it very difficult to finance. Now it's having something that you can label as feminist is probably in some ways an advantage. So I don't know. I think you just have to find what you have to say, what you're interested in, find out what you whether whatever people expect from you. I don't even in an era where feminism is more is sort of culturally acceptable or is more revered, I don't think it's particularly helped me get my films made. I don't think my
Right.
films fit into an easy feminist category. But you just, you know, keep on. It's sort of about marketing, isn't it? Because I mean, I think like, you know, black directors feel like they're being pushed, or black actors, to make a certain kind of black film, and women, they want them to make a kind of feminist film that people are that is predictable, or people are comfortable with. And I think any filmmaker is going to rebel a bit against that, those
Right.
expectations.
Would you say that between the release of these two films from I Shot Andy Warhol to American Psycho, did you feel a sense of growth and confidence in yourself and your filmmaking from what you'd learned in making the first one to then moving on to
Yes,
your sophomore film?
I'm sure I did. It's hard to quantify, but obviously, and my first one had done well, which better than I had ever expected. So that certain gives you a certain boost going
A
in for the
boost,
next.
definitely. And as a director, how do you handle certain challenges or setbacks during production, and what lessons have you learned from overcoming them?
I mean, it's difficult. I've definitely had sort of disastrous production experiences. I've learned one thing I've learned is that I really need to work with a fast DP. Fast cinematographer, because otherwise, you know, you're hours for lighting, and I just never get the budgets that will allow that. So I try and make sure that somebody's fast. I haven't always had easy relationships with the cinematographer. Some I've had great ones and not great ones, and it's really hard to tell. But I need somebody who really understands my way of working and is respectful of it. That I like to change my mind, and I like to kind of find the scene sometimes in the moment and change. Some people get very enraged because it upsets their lighting, but I do like to work, reserve the right to sort of work in the moment and re-block a scene if I feel it's working better another way. A lot of cinematographers will really go with that, but and some won't.
Yeah, I understand the relationship between director and cinematographer is actually quite close. Like, it's quite a fine line because they've got their vision and so have you. So, like, trying to navigate that must be tricky. And how do you work with other people in your department? So, in terms of other creative roles such as costume or production design, how involved do you get in all of this?
I work very, very closely with the production designer always. The production design is very important to me, and I do a lot of work on design. Obviously, a number of my films have been period films, and coming from documentary and being very interested in sort of authenticity, I do a lot of work on that design and supervise that creation of the world. I mean, I think all my films are about creating a world. And it's, for instance, in period design, I just have a lot of sort of theories about or feelings about, like, I don't like where the design is so in your face, like the period design is everything is from 1956 or whatever, that it shocks you. I like to create a world that is really believable. If it's poor, it looks poor. If it's high end, it looks high end. But it doesn't. It's a kind of bed against which the action takes place. So it's about what makes the world alluring or believable or scary or whatever. But it can't distract from the performances or the story.
Well, I've recently watched, I shot Andy Warhol for the first time the other day before this interview, and I really appreciated actually how, I mean, I've never seen the real factory, obviously, but I did appreciate, you know, how it felt very authentic and, you know, I felt like a fly in the wall in that kind of period. But I'm also interested in the production design of American Psycho, actually, because his apartment especially feels so, I would say, like almost clinical. Like it's very, like the kitchen's like the metal. How did you go about deciding on the interiors of
Well,
that?
the designer on that, Gideon Ponte, who was an old friend of mine, a friend of mine from London who I'd been close to for years, and he actually got into film because he was working in the art world and he wanted a change of life. And he came and worked in the art department on I Shot Andy Warhol. And then he went and did another film. And I picked him, even though he wasn't that experienced, to be the designer on American Psycho. He's now super, super successful and he does all of Gucci and stuff like that.
Wow.
And Apple TV, Apple, not Apple TV, Apple, you know. But I gave Gideon some guidelines, and he designed a brilliant set, and architecturally a brilliant set, all the angles. It looked good from every angle. But I said I wanted to look the apartment to be white and to look like a page in Architectural Digest, like nobody at home, nothing personal,
That
no
nobody
personal
cooked there
photos,
in the kitchen.
no personal artifacts. And then I said I wanted the kitchen to be all metal, like a morgue, like stainless steel, like a morgue. And I wanted the bathroom to be sort of black marble. And those were the indications I did. And then he did a great kind of clinical morgue-like kitchen.
No, it's fab. It's really, it's especially when you've got like the contrast of like the blood against the white. It's very like, yeah, the contrast is really remarkable. How would you define success as a director, and what achievements are you most proud of in your career?
I don't know, because most of my films are not, apart from my first one, are not successful at the time. You know, I shot Andy War, American Psycho is much, much more successful now than when it was released. Betty Page, which did not do well when it came, but is more, you know, is more admired now, I'd say. So I would say that the mark of success for me is whether your films are relevant 20 years later or still hold up. And I guess the thing that I'm most proud of is just keeping going and keeping making films in spite of whether they're successful or not, you know, because it's very, very hard for a woman to build a career, I'd say. Even if you have one or two successes, it's very easy to get derailed or just to go and do episodic television or something. But I think to try and build a body of work that reflects something of what you specifically are interested in or your specific sensibility, that I think is the hardest thing to do and what I would most like to do.
I was also going to ask what advice you would offer to aspiring female filmmakers, especially those looking to navigate the industry and carve out their own path.
I mean, I would say I would give what the advice that someone gave to my husband when he was at film school, and which I would give to anybody, male or female, entering the film business, which is that you need a great deal of persistence and a sort of to harden yourself against disappointment and rejection. You know, you have to, as far as you can, to develop a sort of thick skin and to keep going in spite of rejection, which is hard. And it could be people saying no to your scripts to financing, or it could be critics not liking them. I mean, it's just to keep going. And as what I watched the Grammys the other day, and Jay-Z says, you have just have to keep showing up. And I think really just keep showing up as much as you can and keep doing your work, because it's only by doing it that you get better or learn more or develop new aspects of yourself, of your work.
Yeah, I think I've heard that quote from someone else as well, actually, that you've just the most important thing is showing up.
I think that was Woody Allen said that, but
Yeah.
his quote. But I think that, you know, that just turn up, just keep going.
I'd like to ask you sort of what's next for you, and do you have any upcoming projects or genres or characters that you are still eager to explore?
I'm working on a couple things. I'm working on something with Guinevere Turner, you know, who wrote American Psycho, and Betty Page with me, and Charlie Says. So we've had a long history together. We have something that we're working on now that we hope we'll film this year. And then I'm working on something with my husband who wrote Dalai Land with me, my last film.
Okay, exciting. Well, I think I've asked you everything I need to ask today, and it's been really interesting to talk to you. So thank you very much for, yeah, talking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank
Thank
you.
you. Have a lovely
Well,
day. Thank
bless you
you.
too. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Real Girls Club with Mary Harron. It was fascinating to hear about her incredible career, and it was truly a pinch me moment that I got to interview her. You can find all other previous episodes of the podcast here on Spotify. I'll be back soon with another episode, but in the meantime, follow us on Instagram @Real Girls Club for updates, and have a lovely day.